Now I face out, I hold out, I return to the truth of my life, seeking the seas on the whole moment to now break away. Oh God, let me out, can you let me out, can you set me free from this dark in the world, save me the last bit in the
Welcome to another brand new episode of the Social Link Podcast. This is Alex.
And this is Anthony.
How's it going, dude?
It's going. How about yourself, my friend?
Oh, it's going, considering that we're recording back-to-back, you know, episodes.
And you heard that episode last week.
That's right. Last week, this week, you know, or rather, you know, we are recording this on March 6th. So, you know, it's like 7 p.m. my time. I think it's like 8 o'clock your time, right?
It's 7:50.
7:50. Well, you know, close enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, should I even ask you how you've been doing? I mean, it's kind of silly at this point, right? Because we're doing back-to-back episodes. It's like asking you, like, how are you now after we recorded one episode in
after
the can?
After 2 seconds of silence.
Or like, yeah, several minutes of just talking about what we're going to talk about this episode. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. What have you been playing?
I don't think we can... Yeah. Yeah, like something changed between that episode and this episode that somehow we got one video game out, you know, while playing, you know, while doing that episode. But it's, in all seriousness, we have to do something about it. And what we decided on, you know, instead of actually doing like another What You've Been Playing segment, because guess what? You guys already know what we guys have been playing. From the last episode, and as you know, this is all back-to-back recorded. We're going to be talking about, we're going to take this opportunity to actually talk about some board games that we've been playing. How about that?
So I've been playing Bravely Default, just being a smartass, don't pay attention.
Bravely Default, the board game. Now, did you know that Cryptozoic, you know that company, right?
Yes, I do.
Did you know that they actually are publishing a Portal board game?
What the fuck?
Yeah, Valve actually developed a Portal board game, and they approached Cryptozoic to publish it.
Hmm. Cryptozoic. I do own a Cryptozoic game, and that's the DC deck-building game.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, so we have a bunch of people listening to this saying, what the fuck are they talking about? This is a goddamn video game podcast. What the hell is a deck-building game? What is a deck-building game?
It's a game based off of building your deck to score more points. That's basically the concept of
it. You have to elaborate more than that. Does that mean that you have a deck of cards, and then do you draw from it? Do you put stuff in it? I mean, how does that work?
Okay, let's take a look at something like Magic. You have a deck of cards, and in Magic you draw from that deck of cards, thus decreasing it, right?
Sure.
In a deck building game, you have a pool of cards that everyone builds a deck from. Does that make sense?
Okay.
As opposed to, you know, Magic, where you decrease the deck.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So there you go. That's how a deck building game is. And okay. I bought the DC Comics one.
Okay.
Which has been critically acclaimed and also considered Cryptozoic's best deck building game. And it had an expansion that came out last week.
Whoa, last week?
I think so, yeah.
Interesting.
Heroes United, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to, like, take the floor from you, but considering that you haven't really been playing a lot of board games, I wanted to kind of start the What You've Been Playing, in parentheses, board games segment.
Okay.
I played Carcassonne and the Abbey and Mayor expansion last night with both my roommate and friend. Have you played Carcassonne?
I have it, but I haven't played it.
Wait, as in never at all?
Never played. I have it, but I never played it, no.
Oh, Anthony, what the hell is going on with you? Why aren't you playing this? Okay, can I mandate something for you right now? Do you have like maybe $4 or $5?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Do you obviously own an iPhone?
Yes, I do. Well, yeah.
Actually, do you have $10?
No, I don't.
Damn. I was going to tell you to get Carcassonne on iOS.
Okay.
Which is just $10.
Carcassonne. Okay.
Yeah. And we should play it.
Okay.
Yeah. So
this weekend.
Okay. So Carcassonne is basically a tile laying game. And what that is you basically have like a starting tile in the middle, which has half of a town, part of a road, and then a bunch of green areas. The objective of the game is to basically, you know, either complete roads or complete cities. And when you do those and place, you know, these little icon things called meeples, you basically score if you have a meeple in them. Simple enough, right? But right. You alternate with different people putting down tiles and then putting in meeples. So sometimes you probably won't be able to complete a castle, depending on, you know, what available tiles are. So there's a lot of challenge involved when it comes to this, because not only are you strategizing against another player, but you're strategizing against the tiles that's actually coming up. And you only get one tile. You just draw it from a bag, and then you put it down, and then that's it. And then you have a choice of whether to put the meeple there or not. Now, this is... They released this on Xbox Live.
Xbox Live.
So Xbox Live does have this game. But the thing is, I think it's conducive to mobile gaming.
Wasn't it free for a while?
I don't know if it was.
I think it was for, like, because there was an issue with Live or something.
Really? No, really?
Yeah, I remember it being free for some reason. Mm. Which is wild, because Microsoft never offers anything for free.
Yeah, that's true. Well, so right now, okay, this is funny. I'm like looking at Carcassonne right now. Carcassonne on Xbox Live is $9.99 as well.
Okay.
So
I'll just buy it on the iPhone.
Yeah. You know, Carcassonne on Xbox Live is actually in 3D. It's kind of a little bit overkill if you ask me. I think as a tile-based game, it's okay if it's a tile. If it's just, you know, tiles and stuff, like with the artwork, I'm completely fine with that, But basically, like, the Abbey and Mayor expansion actually makes things a little bit complicated. Depending on the strategies in the game, sometimes you'll have areas where there's holes in them, where you can't put any tiles in them. That's when the Abbey comes in. Now, the Abbey is a special tile that each player gets in the expansion. And in lieu of actually grabbing a tile from the bag, you can actually play the Abbey on any space that's surrounded by four tiles.
What?
Yeah. So it changes up the gameplay quite dramatically. There's also a barn and a wagon. The wagon is interesting because if you basically, like, complete the feature that it's on, let's say you complete a road, you can move it to any adjacent incompleted section. So for example, if the road is touching an incomplete city, you can move it out, you can move the wagon once that road is completed to the city. So and the thing is that's cool, you're not even using a turn to put down a meeple.
Nice.
So this seems really alien to a lot of people. But this is a very good strategy game.
And remember, one of the things about board games you gotta understand is there's two main different types of board game. Well, there's different types, obviously, but what I mean is, you gotta understand, Carcassonne is a European game. European games have different things in mind as opposed to American games. Would you not agree?
Yes. One particular important feature of European games is that even though you're lacking in points at the beginning of the game, it doesn't matter because there are long-term strategies that could help you out, you know, like later on.
Okay.
You know, a good example is there's an additional meeple, or I don't know, like token that you can use in Abbey and Mayor called the Barn. And my roommate almost caught up with my friend last night and scored a whopping 32 points.
Jesus.
Just with that barn. That is incredible.
That's insane.
Yeah. So that doesn't sound like a lot of points to a lot of people, but 32 points in a game of Carcassonne is a big deal.
It's kind of like getting like, what you would call it, like 40 points in the game of hockey.
Something like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like a high-scoring hockey game.
Yeah, that's a very high score. But you know what I mean, though.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So that's that. I did take a look at Touch of Evil. Touch of Evil is the game that Anthony has been wanting me to check out. It's from Flying Frog Productions. I didn't know it was a deck-building game.
It kind of is, yeah.
Yeah, because I
love it to death, though.
Yeah, because I know that Fortune and Glory and What was the other game? Last Night on Earth. They're both actual board games, and they're both from Flying Frog Productions. But I was really surprised, you know, to see that Touch of Evil like that. Like, it was like a deck building game. It was a card game. I was like, whoa. Okay.
It's kind of a strange hybrid of deck building and a board game, because there is a board and miniatures.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, Touch of Evil has, it uses cards, but it has a board and it has miniatures in it.
Okay.
So, unless they made a card game of it that I'm not aware of.
I mean, you play with mostly cards, though, or with cards, though, right?
You do to a degree. You also have to use the board as a strategy, and like depending on what place you go to, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can buy items in that game too.
So okay,
like,
okay. I do have to ask this question, because we kind of talked about Pathfinder like on the phone and stuff, like, which is an RPG system. This is different from the Pathfinder pen and paper RPG.
Yeah.
There's a card game called Pathfinder Adventure Card Game, which is also an RPG, but okay. it's handled by somebody different. What is the objective of Touch of Evil?
The objective of Touch of Evil is this. It takes place in, and it's a thematic objective, it takes place in the 16th century, 18th century, 1700s, in a sleepy little village, right?
Okay.
You go into this village as a different character who has its own backstory and all that. And you find out that this village is cursed. Each game, you face a different foe. These foes are different monsters. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the goal is, if you play competitively, to defeat the monster before your other players do. If you play cooperatively, to defeat the monster together. Or if you play cooperatively, competitively, like teams of two or something like that, defeat the other team.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You have to beat it in a certain time frame, because there's a certain time frame. If you don't beat it in a certain time frame, it's like if darkness falls or something like that. I forgot exactly what it was. The game's over because the creature's all powerful and the town gets wiped.
Got it.
Right. Now, the unique thing about A Touch of Evil is this. Each monster is different. That's what makes the game so goddamn cool. You come with the four base monsters, right?
Right.
Vampire, werewolf, headless horseman, and I always forget what the last one was. I think, is it Banshee, or isn't that in the expansion? I don't remember. But you come with those four monsters, right? Mm-hmm. Each monster plays differently, and they are controlled by cards, and what's unique is their strategies are different. The vampire plays differently from the scarecrow. You know, the vampire will, like, do things. It has its own set of cards where it'll do things like turn into a mist, seduce townspeople, and, you know, it'll attack townspeople, things like that.
Okay.
The werewolf, this is one of the coolest things. The werewolf, if you get bitten by a werewolf, there's rules where your character will turn into a fucking werewolf.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing about A Touch of Evil. Each experience is different. And Flying Frog is very generous that not only do you get the monsters in the expansion, they have online monsters for free that you could go download and print out.
Okay.
So is the game complex? Not at all. It's very easy to play. It may not sound like it, but it is.
So, let's kind of get to the nitty-gritty of some of these things. So how does a typical turn work? That's really more important to me.
Okay. Shit. And it's been a while since I've played it. Okay?
Okay.
You're asking me such... Look,
turns are important, especially in video... In board games, you know? Because that's the representative of the gameplay in board gaming. So, you know, so to me, that's more important than anything else. Like, you can tell me about the theme and how amazing it is, but if it plays like shit, doesn't matter. Which is interesting to me, because in video games, like, it could go both ways, right? Like, but the thing is, with board gaming, the gameplay is crucial. Like, that is, like, number one most important thing in board games. Like, yeah, it could look like shit, but if the game is awesome... Like, it'll work just fine.
Okay. If I remember correctly, and if anyone has played Touch of Evil, correct the fuck out of me. Some of it's coming back to me. you can use your turn to explore areas in the board in the area, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's also cool about that game is each area on the map has its own deck of cards that set it apart. So, like, if you go to the Lost Forest and you can investigate it. What the thing is you're looking for weapons and items and clues to defeat the enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you go to the forest, dangers will vary. So, like, for example, if you go to the forest, you could pull a card and look for an item, get a weapon, right?
Right.
Okay? So what the game is it deck builds, and it deck builds so that way you're powerful enough to face the monster. You investigate, or you could challenge the monster right away. Of course, you're going to get your fucking ass kicked if you do that right away.
Mm-hmm.
You can confront another player. You can investigate. There's also a mechanic where they have a trader system where you can investigate four townspeople, and one of them is a trader. They're actually working for the monster.
Mm-hmm.
You can, like, for example, I'll give you an example. You can move to two places, or you can move to, like, one place and investigate. So say you move to the Lost Woods, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You investigate it. You pull a card from the Lost Woods deck, and you could say, oh, you meet a town's girl, she heals you, whatever, right?
Right.
Or you can say, Tangle, trees come alive. The trees immobilize you. You cannot move.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Or you can use that turn to go to the blacksmith and buy items. Now, I'll be honest, I'm not giving an accurate description of turns because I have not played it in a while. Okay. But that's one game I hope I can play tomorrow and I can give you an accurate description of tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But you investigate, you move, they're very quick turns too. The problem with turns in some games, one of my favorites is Merchant of Martyrs, but one of its biggest flaws is turns take too long. You cannot have turns take too long, right?
Right.
Turns in A Touch of Evil are very, very quick. So there you go. That's another thing. Like I said, you could challenge the monster, you can investigate, you can do all kinds of other things.
Mm. I see.
You know, and there's a limit of what you can do. Like, you can move, like, you can, like, what's cool about it is you have choice. Like, if I remember, you can use your whole turn just to move, or you can, like, I think you can move up to three spaces or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can move the three spaces, move three times, or you can move once, and it may not even be three. You can move once, investigate, and then move again, or something like that, or investigate, move, investigate, stuff like that.
I see.
So there's a lot of options in choice in that game. With what the options they give you, you can do multiple things.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. When you have choice like that, I don't know if you agree with me, I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I always like, you know, choices and stuff like that when it comes to those kinds of things. I think that, I want to say, like, the Pathfinder adventure card game is very similar when it comes to that sort of thing. But I think the one game that has a lot of choice in general is this game called Robinson Crusoe, The Adventure on Cursed Isle. Now, have you heard of that game?
No, I have not.
Oh, man. Okay, I have to ask then, have you ever played a worker placement game?
I play Puerto Rico.
Okay, so just to explain to people, the way that worker placement games work is that there, you know, obviously there's a board, right? And what happens is, like, each player gets a finite amount of workers, and what they do is they basically take turns between one player and another, and they place one worker on a space to occupy. Now, the catch-22, of course, is that if that player actually puts their worker there, no other players can put their workers on that space. Right?
Okay.
I think that's an accurate representation of a worker placement game, right?
Yeah, I would say so, too.
Now, Robinson Crusoe, Adventure in Cursed Isle, is unique because it is a co-op worker placement game. And most worker placement games are competitive, right? So here's how it works. There's different phases, and I'm just going to really, really, really distill this in its very basic form. There are six scenarios that you can play, each with varying degrees of objectives. One is, you basically have to kind of, you know, create settlements within the first 12 months or within the year, you know, preparing for, like, you know, maybe a ship go, you know, coming in to save you within, you know, the 10th, 11th, and 12th month. But in order to do that, you need to learn how to do certain things, like maybe create, you know, learn how to make fire, learn how to make a signal, you know, like maybe be able to make food. What's interesting about Robinson Crusoe is there's a lot of things that are against you. You need to be able to feed everybody in your group, because if you're not able to feed everybody in your group, you'll lose health. And this is different in such a way that when you lose health in Robinson Crusoe, when you get to a certain point, everybody's morale lowers. And when when morale lowers, it gets a lot more difficult to complete certain tasks. In order to do certain things, you get, you know, each player gets 2 tokens. And this is kind of like where it gets a little tricky. When you start the game, you only have 1 tile unveiled, and you can actually either explore the island, hunt for food, or, you know, or various other things, like create an item, for example.
Yeah.
But the thing is that there is a chance involved. So and to mitigate the chance, you can divide your time. So in other words, you get the two tokens that are given to you, which are considered workers in other games.
Right.
They simulate the amount of effort that you would do in order to complete a certain task. So here's a good example. Let's say I wanted to explore a space separate, you know, like separate from myself, and I'm the only one exploring this space, and you decide that you're going to put in the other place that I'm going to explore, because I have 2 tokens, right? So I'm exploring 2 different spaces. You decide that in one of the spaces that I'm occupying, that you're going to help me out, so you place 1 token there. That means, because, you know, there's at least 2 tokens there from 2 different players or the same player, that means we successfully explored that area of the island without any sort of consequence. Now, how about the one space that has 1 of my tokens? Well, there is a consequence involved, and that is determined by rolling dice. And you roll the dice that corresponds to the particular action. In this case, we're exploring the island. So you roll the dice corresponding to that. If you roll a letter V, that means you're victorious. You have successfully explored that. However, there are 2 other dice that can determine whether something bad can happen.
Oh, so fuck.
When something bad happens, you draw a card from the corresponding pile. In this case, there is a pile specifically devoted to exploration. So you draw the card and you read it. This gives you a choice. Okay?
Wow.
Which is really fantastic. So here's the thing. Here's a good example. There's a card, there's a top portion and a lower portion of the card. You always read the top portion of the card initially when you actually draw it from that deck. So you read, it says, you find a, you know, an abandoned shack, blah, blah, blah. It could be very well be, you know, like, you know, somebody's, you know, shack and all that stuff that's been long abandoned. If you explore the shack, you have a chance of discovering X item or something like that, you know? But if you decide to go in, you have to take that card and put it into the event deck. The event deck is basically a deck that's predetermined at the beginning of the game, and you always draw it at the beginning of everybody's turn. Cumulatively. So what happens
is it a cheap game?
Huh?
Is it a cheap game?
What do you mean a cheap game?
Like, is it cheap or is it expensive?
Expensive. So you have a choice whether to just ignore it or to actually get those things, but with the notion that something bad might happen later on throughout your adventure. So let's say I decide, okay, I'm going to take my chances, I'm going to explore it, and I got a really cool item, but now I have to put that card in the event deck. And the scary part is that you know something bad is going to happen. You know something bad is going to happen within the next few turns. Okay, So once that appears again, you have to resolve the bottom portion of the card. In that particular card's case, it says you have this. You are constantly haunted by the ghosts of Robinson Crusoe, and it'll say, like, you know, have everybody lose like 1 morale or something like that.
Oh fuck!
You know, so these are the kind of things that you can weigh, you know, in terms of like the gameplay and stuff. And it's really, really interesting because there is a real risk and reward system that's really built into the game. And it is quite possibly the hottest shit right now on BoardGameGeek. So it is made by, I can't pronounce his name, Ignacy Trewiczek.
What's the publisher?
Z-Man Games.
Ah, Z-Man, okay.
Yeah, it is published by Portal Games in Europe. You know, they have their own publishing company there, but it is published by Z-Man Games. And I have to say, the artwork is fantastic. So the character, and what's really neat too, and just the attention to detail, right? The character cards that you get in the game are double-sided. They have different classes, of course, in the game, but it's double-sided because there's a female version and a male version of the same class.
Nice.
No difference. It's just, you know, if you want to play as a female, you could. If you want to play as a male, you could. Again.
You play as a female, I'm sure.
Honestly, I haven't played the game yet, but I'm anxious to kind of start it. It is a 2-hour game, though. That's not a short game. It's fine for you, but you know, I play with friends who have short spurts and stuff like that, and you know, we're trying to grab more people in, but it's been kind of a challenge because sometimes, you know, some of these games overwhelm people. But I'm hoping like in the future and stuff, when people get really comfortable, like later down the year, like I can start busting out like Robinson Crusoe or Descent, you know, like not Descent. I'm trading that game in. And you know, like other games like Eldritch Horror and all that stuff, you know. So
yeah,
so really good stuff.
Good old board games.
Yep.
Definitely. We'll be talking more about board games.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, oh well.
I think what we'll do is like, you know, every second episode that we record, like on the same night and stuff, we'll be recording every 2 weeks basically. We're gonna make it like a, you know, what you've been playing in board games. I think that's fair. So Anthony, the next time we talk to each other, well, we'll talk to each other a lot sooner than our recording, but the next time we record, I expect you to have played at least Elder Sign.
I should be, yes, tomorrow.
You say that.
Well, I should be. If not, I'll play it solo.
Okay, all right. I am interested to see like what you think of it.
It'll be good, I think. It'll be good.
Okay, I will hound you next week. And make sure you play that game.
Oh, I will. I will. You just have to trust me. I have plan on going to some friends tomorrow, so hopefully we'll be playing that game. We're supposed to play Once Upon a Time as well, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually know how Once Upon a Time works. I'm not too thrilled about it.
Well, here's the thing. You have to be pretty creative for that game to work, so.
Well, I'm a pretty creative guy, but
but
the thing is, like, you need to find other people who can tell a good story, and sometimes that just doesn't work.
That's true.
You know, it is solely reliant on the storytelling talents of other people.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think I like it, though. But, I mean, look, one thing you and I talked about, this will be a good thing to close on, is we said, you selling Mansions of Madness, I say it's great. But here's the thing. Each gaming group when you play board games is going to differ. Mm-hmm. And even another thing that's unique about gaming groups is if you play with a different mix of people, that group is going to differ as well. So that's the tricky thing about recommending games. I love Mansions of Madness. Alex's group, it doesn't work for it, though. But that's fine. That's how these games are designed, right?
Right.
So the beautiful thing about board games is they're just not, you know, they're designed for different people. Like, okay, now some games are ridiculous, like getting Battlestar Galactica, come on. I'll agree. 8 hours? 8 hours? Mm-hmm. But I don't mind a game, you know, like, it depends on my groups. If we want to, we might have a different mood, so we might be like, oh, let's play one game of Mansions of Madness and one quick game like Castle Panic, right?
Right.
Or we could play a bunch of games like we could play Castle Panic, Touch of Evil, Last Night on Earth. There you go, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we work. You work a little bit differently. That's cool. That's the beauty of board games.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I got to say on that.
Right. And there's a variety of other experiences. But
yeah.
Anyways, so let's go into your rant. So what are you going to be talking about this week on your rant?
Let's talk about boycotts and petitions and all that self-entitled bullshit.
Are you talking about, like, change.org and all the really ridiculous, like, you know, like, I don't know, deport Justin Bieber from the United States kind of stuff, or?
Well, that I don't mind, but,
Okay, so you're part of the problem, too. You admit it.
Well, here's the thing. I never signed it, though. I don't really care. You know, look, those petitions aren't going to work. And I'm talking a lot about video game petitions. I even bring back the Mass Effect controversy to a degree. Look, I'm hearing a lot of people just throw around the word boycott. I'm going to boycott Nintendo. I'm going to boycott EA. I'm going to boycott that. People throw that word around just to fucking sound important and as if they're going to lead some sort of change. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work. So, would you like to hear more, Alex?
Yes, let's.
Okay, so this rant is about something that I bitched about before. A couple years back when Alex and I did the original Gamer Horizon podcast, a little game called Mass Effect 3 came out. Holy fuck, did that game piss off people. Worst ending ever. Ending worst. Worst horrible ending. Shut up. Okay, it wasn't the worst ending ever. You guys don't know what a fucking horrible ending was. But it pissed off a lot of people that they decided to fight the system. Yeah, let's fight the system and be cool. We're rebels. We'll be like Occupy fucking Wall Street and fucking protest it and go against the evil overlords of EA. So they started a petition called Take Back Mass Effect or whatever the fuck it was. I still see people throw around boycott, throw around petitions. You know what? Why? Are you self-entitled to this? Are you? That's the problem with the internet. Internet makes fucking people feel they're self-important. And that's fine because a lot of people, I'm sad to say, who use the internet on a regular basis have no fucking self-confidence. And you know what? If that makes you self-confident, fine. But don't fucking make it into self-entitlement. I talked about this in an earlier round when some motherfucker called in Nintendo whining about Super Mario Bros. 3. Really? Really? And you post it on the internet? Your fucking boycott, your fucking your shit isn't gonna say, do anything. The people throw around the word boycott to make themselves look edgy and cool and a badass. No. No. You know how you fucking don't like something from a company? You don't fucking buy their product if you really dislike a company. It's really not that hard. But nope, we have to have people here. Let's start a movement and start fucking, let's start writing. Shut up. You guys act like you're in Vietnam or some shit. It's a fucking video game. I complain, I do reviews, but I don't fucking go around making, you know, starting a movement, being the leader of the rebel cause. No. No, what is that gonna do? First and foremost, these companies don't give a fuck about your petitions, boycotts, or whatever. They don't. They don't listen to you 90% of the time. They don't work. But nope, you don't seem to give a fuck. You think because you're on the internet and you have a voice, your opinion is right. Well, here's what I often find on the fucking internet. Mostly people don't know what the fuck they're talking about. They don't back up shit by facts. And that doesn't just go for video games. It goes for anything. You know, look at fucking another movement that fucking faltered and fell on its face. It's not video game related. Remember Kony 2012 from 2 years ago? Stop Kony. Those fucking idiots didn't know the fucking facts. They didn't know Kony might even be fucking dead. But nope, they started a movement to get fucking attention, and then the dude went fucking psychopathic. And fucking, yeah, we know what happened there. Look, here's the thing. Boycotts and internet stuff are often backed up by lack of knowledge or over bias. That's why most of them don't fucking work. Okay? Most of them don't fucking work. There are some that have been good. I'm not saying all are bad. Operation Rainfall is one that has been nothing but positive. But most of them are, I don't like this ending. I don't like this. I don't like that. Blah, blah, blah. Or stupid things like, let's get Majora's Mask remade. How about a new original Zelda? My God. You know, it's, I shake my head in disgust over this. But you know what? These guys are going to spout out. You know what? Because of this movement, I'll tell you, 2 years ago, Alex and I talked about fucking Mass Effect 3 and the stupid ending for months, which we shouldn't have. At the time, we had other stuff. We had a Witcher 3 port. No, Witcher 2 port that I was excited about at the time. We had a new Tales game. The first Tales games we had received in 4 fucking years. But nope, we had to talk about Mass Effect's ending for 2 years because people wouldn't shut up. They were sending cupcakes and stuff. Shut the fuck up. Your boycotts don't work.
Okay. Wow. So what made you actually like want to talk about this to begin with?
Well, I was on Facebook and I just hear people, I'm going to boycott this all the fucking time. We should boycott this. People boycotting Nintendo, people boycott. And it's for stupid little things, you know? Look, let's talk about Nintendo for a second. You and I, we have a little bit of a differing opinion, but we ultimately agree about Nintendo, correct?
Sure.
To some, okay? They have issues, but there are people boycotting them. They better change their ways. They better have... It's like Wii consoles. One guy was boycotting Nintendo because Wii U isn't selling. That doesn't fuck... If you want Wii to succeed, that's not going to help them, you idiot.
Mm-hmm.
If people don't understand how to boycott... Look, I thought the Mass Effect 3 was completely stupid. Look, I'm not... Look, I want to talk about this for a second. You and I... agreed about the ending, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Our issue was that it was fucking rushed, correct?
Yeah, it seemed rushed.
It seemed rushed. But I don't think it was a cause for a boycott because I have seen shorter endings in modern games. I have seen endings that are a lot more vague. I've seen endings that have disappointed people, but never to the point of causing a boycott like that did.
Mm-hmm.
So who the fuck knows? Look, petitions, boycotts. I think people start it because they think they have a voice. And I think 90% of the time, most of them don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Even some organizations, like I talked about Kony 2012 in that thing. They don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about Justin Bieber for a second. I don't like the little prick. But fuck, who gives a shit? Why do you... You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I hear a lot about his stuff because I listen to Hollywood Babylon with Kevin Smith.
Okay.
And they make fun of him, and it's fucking hilarious. But here's the deal. Ultimately, what Justin Bieber does not affect you. You know, all his prostitutes and his drag racing, well, it might affect people there. I can understand why they get upset that live in his neighborhood. But ultimately, half the shit he does, his cocaine snorting, does not affect. Why do you care so much to deport the little bastard? That's all I got to say on that. It's just people want to, they use the internet to make themselves more important because in reality, they feel that they're not real important. Mm-hmm. Anything from the internet mostly stems from insecurities. There you go.
Okay. All right. That sounds pretty straightforward. I mean, you know, as far as like petitions and boycotts go, I support boycotts, but boycotts with a very good kind of cause. I think the Xbox One boycott last year was, well, you know, good, like good and well founded. I think you know that really shows that the gamers do have the power and the voice to be able to express this. And you know, one of the most unpopular things right now is, you know, is that there's some people out there that think that Microsoft really had a good idea of what to do with digital content. And that and that other gamers, because, and I'm just kind of reversing the tables here, and some gamers feeling entitled for, like, you know, physical copies, I guess, and they're basically calling out people who wanted physical copies of games, basically ruined, you know, Microsoft's, I guess, alleged innovation of, you know, like, the next console generation. I don't feel that way. I feel that, you know... There's a reason why console gaming is so much more popular than PC gaming, and I think one of the main things that makes console gaming a lot more popular is the people's ability to be able to barter, trade, and sell, and borrow games from their friends. And, you know, that's not self-entitlement, it's just being able to feel like you own the object that you bought. Sure. Video games are inherently licenses, and we're basically purchasing a license to be able to play the game. But that doesn't mean that we can't transfer the license with our own, you know, with our own free will. And that's what's been going on with the industry over the past 10 years or so. That's why, you know, GameStop is so lucrative. As much as I don't necessarily like agree with some of the prices that they buy games for, it is, you know, part of that economy. if you strip that away from it, you know, like, who's to say that you're not going to prevent, like, smaller mom-and-pop stores from being able to do the same, you know what I mean?
Right, right, right.
But again, that's kind of like an example of how a boycott could help. And that, you know, there's a difference of, you know, a different kind of self-entitlement that is more positive rather than negative.
But I often find time that half of these petitions are over stupid things. And look, the Xbox One is an exception. I even mentioned Operation Rainfall. Those are exceptions, right? To the rule.
Right.
Okay. But the Mass Effect one was so fucking stupid. They're, you know, boycotting Nintendo over not selling enough Wii U's. Selling, it's just, look, here's my problem. This is why I get into so many internet arguments till to this day. I often find that people don't know what the fuck they are talking about 90% of the time, Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that is fucking true. Most people, and this goes to comic books or, you know, or stuff like that. When they complain about casting for Man of Steel 2, when they complain about, fucking, you know, what the hell was it, you know, about certain things, they don't know what they're talking about. And what's sad is a lot of people get behind these. And you go off and you tell them, look, you don't know what the fuck you're talking. You give them facts, you're a troll. That's the problem. Most people don't know what they're talking about. The Xbox One, yeah, people knew what they're talking about. So when you start a boycott, most of the time, it's stupid because of that simple fact.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Right.
So okay. Boycott. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I was going to move on, but yeah, okay. I mean, you basically pretty much said in your rant, like, whatever needed to be said about boycotts and petitions. And, you know, hopefully, like, the people who listen to it kind of apply, you know, their own opinions and their own thoughts in it as well. And kind of, like, don't, you know, like, think for yourself. Don't try to be swayed by a lot of people. I know it's really difficult because, you know, you're part of the zeitgeist of, you know, what's happening and stuff. But, you know, it is what it is. And I think that if, you know, the more that you become an individual is like by kind of questioning, wait, is this actually going to make sense? Am I just driven by emotion? I mean, we're pretty emotional video gamers anyway. As video gamers, we are pretty emotional people. But sometimes there are things that you know, personally, I'd much rather not spend time on. So anyways, moving on to our next subject matter. So what's next, dude? So, are we going to be talking about shooters? Because this week, or next week, this week when this podcast comes out, Titanfall came out. And I'm pretty sure at least two of the Gamer Horizon crew is playing that nonstop as we release this episode.
Okay, let's talk about shooters. There's a common misconception in my fan base, the YouTube and stuff. People automatically say, I hate shooters. I don't hate shooters, okay? I don't hate shooters. I hate what shooters have become, though. Does that make sense?
Well, to me, but I don't know if the listeners can...
Okay. To me, you know, you look at the shooter and you look at its development, right? What the shooter has become is this sort of prideful, sort of arrogant type thing. This kind of... And what I mean by arrogant, it became less of experience and more about pride. And what I mean by that is when Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare came out, that kind of changed the landscape of multiplayer forever. And, you know, I will go to this, as much as critical as I am of Call of Duty these days, that Modern Warfare game is a fucking work of genius still to this day. Okay, Alex?
Mm-hmm.
I think it is. Its campaign is anyway. Its multiplayer, you could tell, was just what it was. It was a multiplayer experience, and it worked. But as the series went on, it became more about multiplayer, 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 multiplayer. It became about people bragging rights, became people about getting, you know, perks and, you know, kill streaks and all this stuff. And a lot of the stuff was cheap. It was basically the equivalent of Final Fantasy summons in the game. You get a 5-kill streak, I'll summon a fucking helicopter. Oop, he'll kill people for me. My kill streak went up. I'll summon a fucking nuke. There you go. That's what shooters have become. What shooters were, though, were you know, if you look at Doom 3, Doom 3 is a prime example of what the shooter was a very quiet, frightening experience. It wasn't just horror, but that was an example. I love Half-Life. Half-Life was a shooter that told a brilliant science fiction story. Halo 3, again, brilliant science fiction story. The best shooter I played in recent years have been Halo 4 because of its excellent campaign. I think shooters have become too much about the multiplayer and not enough about a single player experience. When they get it right, they can tell an amazing game. There you go. What do you think, Alex?
I haven't played a lot of shooters in a long time, but the thing is, I'll harp on one game again that I've been telling you to play, which has been by far one of my most favorite single-player experiences in a first-person shooter over the past decade or so.
Okay.
Do you know what this is?
BioShock Infinite? Oh, no, Far Cry 3. Far Cry 3.
Okay. Yeah, BioShock Infinite is style over substance. I mean, okay. That's kind of unfair. There is some substance to the storyline of BioShock Infinite. The thing is that I don't like is that there are still some missing things in BioShock Infinite, and I think it's a different kind of level of detail that BioShock Infinite has compared to BioShock. But anyways, Far Cry 3 did not have it did have like a multiplayer mode, but the thing is, it's like, the actual single-player mode was so rich that I could get myself lost in that game forever.
Okay.
For hours. And they're one of the few, right? But the thing is, you get games like BioShock Infinite, which has a really fantastic, you know, like, production value. Like, there's so much detail in the world. It feels living and stuff. It's like, it's so much bigger than what it is, right?
Yeah,
I think what you're mentioning is more so along the lines of like military shooters than anything else. Because if you look at the landscape of first-person shooters, there's actually quite a variety of first-person shooters that are coming out.
Right now there is, because the military shooters I think the military shooter is becoming what the World War II shooter became, where people just got burnt out on it. Remember that?
I can kind of see that, but the thing is, the World War II shooter just evolved into the modern shooter. You know, yeah. it didn't really, it wasn't like a whole genre died, it just evolved. You know, it's unlike the music genre, which it's just completely dead right now. You know?
Oh, fuck.
You know, it's not like that at all. It is more like, you know, and I feel that Titanfall, as much as I'm not liking the game, I mean... Again, I am a first. I'm a single player kind of player, or a co-op gamer, right? Local co-op gamer. Like, if I need another Xbox or PlayStation to do co-op, fuck that. I am turned off by it, because I have a roommate who's like really into games, and I want to be able to play games, you know, with them and stuff, you know, and it's important to me to be able to have that experience. Yeah, you could basically say, oh, you can drop another 400 or 500 bones on it, but that goes without saying, it's another $400 or $500 of the same, you know, of the same platform, and buying another game to do that sort of thing. Anyways, withstanding, that's why I don't play a lot of co-op or multiplayer games on console.
You've never been a fan of that. As long as I've known you, you've never been a fan of that.
It's also several things, right? It's also the timing of it. Like, you have to basically schedule time with your friends to be able to do that. Which, you know me. Like, I'm a social butterfly. Like, I need to be able to kind of like just pop in and say, hey, all right, I'm gonna do this or I'm gonna do that. Like, even when I was an active multiplayer gamer, and that is evidenced by basically reaching 100 battles in both the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 versions of Mortal Kombat in 2011.
Oh, God damn.
Yeah. I had never, like, in all those games, I would have to say less than 1% of the time I was actually playing with somebody I knew in real life.
Okay.
So
I gotcha.
99% of the time I'm playing with complete strangers. And I'm like, you know, as much as I know that they could be cool people, because I'm cool when I play with, you know, with people online, right? Like, I, you know, I don't rage quit or anything like that. And when people do rage quit, I basically say GG, and, you know, they'll retaliate, and I don't give a shit. But the thing is, you're still playing with strangers, and that's what's interesting to me about, like, the PS4, is that they're trying to bring the couch, you know, couch gaming again, you know, the feeling of it, at the very least, you know, to people, to everybody. You know, it's still not perfect. I still can't play, you know, like, a shooter with, you know, with my roommate and stuff like that, you know, like, together and play it through co-op. We're not there yet. But we're getting to that point where that's actually respectable. And if we look at the upcoming first-person shooter games, single-player experiences might just be a thing of the past, because a lot of these single player experiences are now being hybrids of both single player and multiplayer experiences, which is why I feel that Titanfall is such an important directional change for first person shooters, because it tries to create a narrative and a meaning to every single multiplayer battle that you participate in. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a single tied storyline, so it is not like a single player experience. But I can see how, you know, that could be created in such a way that it could be a really rich single player experience with multiplayer elements. So, like, let's say the battles that you're participating in and stuff like that, you know, are actually, I don't know, like, maybe, you know, maybe this is a battle that determines whether or not you advance in the storyline, and how you perform in that battle, you know, kind of changes the storyline a little bit and stuff, you know? Like, I feel that that could be an interesting direction for multiplayer gaming, so that there is a conflict, there is an ongoing conflict between the players and stuff, and that there is some sort of finite end, and a satisfying finite end, and then that allows you to continue even further. I think Titanfall does scratch that surface, and that's what makes me interested about the game, even though I'm very averse to multiplayer gaming. You know, and I think that moving forward, as we approach, like, the release of games like Destiny, we're going to see a lot more interesting iterations of this kind of thought and kind of technology and stuff. And I'm really anxious to kind of see how that will advance the genre.
It'll be interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think about that? Like, you know, just what I said.
You know what? I don't want to see single-player experiences as they are go away. I don't think they ever will, to be honest. However, this hybrid, you know, that you're talking about is an idea that is pretty cool, and it works. Because here's the thing. My problem with multiplayer right now is, like, Call of Duty, it's just a prestige, right? Mm-hmm. There's no emotional involvement.
Well, there is an emotional involvement. Well, as far as the multiplayer, yes. There's no emotional involvement, really.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's an emotional involvement, but it's detached from the game. It's not involved in the game. Does that make sense?
What do you mean?
Like, rage quitting and stuff like that, it's more of emotional things, like getting angry at people who are playing the game as opposed to the game itself.
Okay.
When you play a single-player game with a deep story and stuff, you get connected to characters, the world, etc., etc. I think when you do that with a multiplayer function, that's pretty cool. But you have to be careful, because when you play multiplayer, you know, you got to have friends. That's the thing. When you play multiplayer, you have to play with friends, because if you play with strangers, they will take advantage of you. Not saying all of them will. They'll take advantage of you. Teamwork will go out the window, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So having a story in a multiplayer world is a cool idea, but you just got to have the friends. Mm-hmm. There you go. That's all I got to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure they have Titanfall.
Wait, what do you
mean? You know,
well, I mean, if you want to play Titanfall with friends, obviously they would need Titanfall. Yeah. I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, it's just, I don't know. I'm single player. I'm with you. I like the single player experience. I think it's a neat idea, but I don't know how it would work or whatnot.
Honestly, I'm anxious to see what Bungie is going to do with Destiny.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, you know, that doesn't have a monthly fee or anything like that. It is just, I mean, their plan for that game is huge. They have a 10-year plan for that game.
Jesus.
And that the world is going to evolve along with the players. So, you know, this is different from previous FPS MMOs out there, like PlanetSide and PlanetSide 2 and whatever else. And definitely different than Borderlands. Because, I mean, if this is basically a massively multiplayer FPS with lots of questing and lots of exploration and stuff, this might even blow Borderlands out of the water. Now, mind you, there's a difference in theme between Destiny and Borderlands. Borderlands is a lot more comedic and very kind of chunky in a way, but Destiny is billed as an epic. So I am interested to see how Destiny will turn out. And I'll be honest, I am buying a PlayStation 4 for Destiny. Not any other game, but for Destiny. That's it.
Well, I'm buying buying it for Final Fantasy.
That's not coming out this year.
I know, but that's why for down the road. But Destiny, we'll see. Bungie's pretty good at telling stories, and they're good at creating lore and mythologies. So they have a 10-year plan. They're pretty serious about it, you know.
Yeah.
So that, I think it's something to watch. I think it's something to watch.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting either way, right?
Right. Right, right, right. As far as for me for shooters, we're probably going to be closing out here soon. My last word too is I would like to see Half-Life 3. That's just me. I know you're not.
Yeah. Good luck with that, buddy.
That's like.
So let's think about this for a second. When did Half-Life 1 come out?
98, 99.
When did Half-Life 2 come out?
2004.
So that's like how many years? Like.
8 years, I would say.
Yeah.
No, six years.
Yeah. We're about due for another one.
Yeah, we are. But it seems like Valve is more focused on Steam and Portal at the moment, so.
Well, when did we get the last, Half-Life episode game?
2007.
Okay, so it's been a while. Yeah. So maybe 6 years after that.
Yeah, who knows?
Oh, wait, no, we're past that already.
Yeah. But look, let me put it this way. Half-Life 3 may be my Shenmue 3. There you go.
Oh, gosh, you actually compared it.
Well, I compared it because, it may not happen, and I'll have to accept that. Because, Shenmue 3, people accept, please accept it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And
It's like, what was it? It's almost likening it to the Loch Ness Monster or something, like, in its rarity. I don't know.
Or God. Oh, well, okay. I won't go there. But that's me being an unreligious asshole right there. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, since we can't read mail, because we've already read the mail last episode. Yeah, thanks, Anthony. By the way, you gotta make sure that itinerary is pretty ironclad. Again, we're recording this back-to-back with the previous episode, so we ran out of mailbags, mailbox segments. So, if you want to email us at, the Social Link Podcast, email us at sociallinkpodcast@gamerhorizon.com. We will read it on the air, we will comment on it, and we'll probably save it for a future episode. I would think that would be cool to do is to have like an episode dedicated for letters, like maybe the second episode that we record during the night would just to answer any questions that people have, right? I think that'd be cool.
Yeah. We need more emails, guys. We really do.
And
one thing we can do is the more emails we get when we do these double recordings, we could split the emails in half so we could have a set of emails for one recording.
Mm-hmm. Or dedicate like one episode to it, So it's all your questions and emails and whatnot. So, but in any case, so again, email us at sociallinkpodcast@gamerhorizon.com. Also rate us on iTunes. Because that's important. That actually increases our visibility and stuff. Let your friends know. Post it on your wall. Kind of share it. There's like a share, like a Facebook share button on, the podcast and stuff on the actual website on GamerHorizon.com. Share us with people. Let them know that we're back. Anthony and I are back. We'd like to help spread the word for it. Because I think, what we're doing is actually really different than what most people are doing. And we want to kind of continue to create like a conversation between us and you guys, because that's really, really important.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Social media is very important. You know, I used to be anti-Facebook, but I realize now how important it is.
Yes.
So there you go.
Mm-hmm. So again, visit us at GamerHorizon.com. Email us at SocialLinkPodcast@GamerHorizon.com. Follow us on Twitter at Twitter.com/GamerHorizon. And of course, like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/GamerHorizon. So Anthony, do you have any final words?
That's about it. You can visit my channel at YouTube.com/user/MegaSexual.
Sweet, you actually got it right this time around.
Yay, after 5 years.
So until next time, guys, we'll see you guys later.